The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount. Hello and welcome to the Bitcoin Standard podcast seminar. In today's seminar, we're going to be discussing some news in the Bitcoin space and then also going over some questions that I've received by email from some of our participants who are taking our SaferDean.com courses in economics. Welcome to take these by registering for membership on SaferDean.com and register for Membership Plus to join these seminars. We begin first with news from the insurance industry and Bitcoin. Just yesterday, NYDIG, the institutional financial services provider for Bitcoin for institutions, and one of the sponsors of this podcast and the company that I've worked with, they've announced the appointment of New York Life Chairman and CEO Matas to their board of directors. And I think this is a hugely significant bit of news because New York Life is one of the world's biggest insurance companies, and its CEO is a well-known and well-respected titan in the insurance industry who's been around for a very long time. And this is a company that deals with life insurance, which is really the most conservative kind of assets and most conservative policies.
And the fact that this company is getting into Bitcoin, in my opinion, is extremely important, because not only is the CEO, Ted Mathas, not only is he the CEO of New York Life, he's also the chairman of the American Council of Life Insurers, which represents 280 member companies, which collectively represent more than 95% of the life insurance industry in the US and more than $7 trillion in assets. So that's just the life insurers. It's around $7 trillion in assets that they have. So I think the significance of this is quite enormous. We've, over the past few months, I think maybe the most important development that happened in the Bitcoin space was the emergence of the case for Bitcoin for corporations. Thanks to Michael Saylor, in no small part, the fact that he went out and announced the purchase of his Bitcoins and then put out the entire corporate playbook for how to buy Bitcoin, and then spoke to the world about what Bitcoin can offer, and, you know, managed to convince some corporations all over the country and the world to buy more Bitcoin, is truly remarkable. And the case for putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet instead of holding dollars and negative yielding bonds for public companies is quite compelling, because as Saylor puts it, these public companies have a fiduciary duty to look after their assets, and watching what is happening with bonds and with cash would make it their duty really to look to protect themselves from that. And Bitcoin provides the optimal protection. So I think that's a pretty compelling case. And I think we're going to be seeing a significant amount of corporate balance sheets holding cash positions in Bitcoin. But I also think potentially the insurance industry getting into Bitcoin is maybe even bigger. The life insurance industry is about $7 trillion. And I've seen estimates that the entire industry, including property and casualty, could be like $9 trillion or something like that. It's probably a little bit larger as well. And that's an enormous amount of money. And most of it is in bonds. Most of it goes into bonds. And so the implication of the insurance industry switching from switching at least some of their negative yielding bond positions into Bitcoin, I think, is huge, because, you know, New York Life, being one of the most conservative and one of the most well-known insurance companies, will definitely attract many of the other companies to pay attention. And also a few months ago, Mass Mutual, which is also another one of the largest insurance companies in the U.S., announced that they bought $200 million of Bitcoin. And they also took a minority stake in NYDIG. So they have a small investment in NYDIG. So it's clear that people and influential companies in the insurance industry are getting into the Bitcoin space. And I think this is enormously interesting because, you know, potentially the size of the balance sheets that the insurance industry have are arguably even larger than the public companies. And also because really the general account for insurance companies, in order to be an insurance company and have a general account that backs people's life insurance policies, is probably the highest level of regulation and regulatory oversight that you could come across. And so the fact that these companies can get into Bitcoin is just an enormous testament to how far Bitcoin has come, and just how much larger of a potential market is available for Bitcoin from now on. So it's quite encouraging to see it if you're a Bitcoiner, because that's a huge market, but also because I think this is leading us more and more toward seeing where the value proposition for Bitcoin is. And it's becoming more and more clear that Bitcoin is a replacement for bonds. It's a very good replacement for bonds because, you know, now bonds are offering negative yields. And, you know, the point from bonds is that the reason people hold bonds is that they look for value preservation. You know, bonds are not the place where you're trying to get rich. Bonds are the place where you're trying to protect yourself from inflation. And then you take risks with stocks or with other kinds of investments. But bonds are generally what people look for when they're looking for something safe. And so insurance companies will generally hold a lot of bonds. And so if they switch, if they can see the value proposition in Bitcoin, which I think really is quite compelling if you're in the insurance industry, I can see this massively disrupting bonds. It's absolutely fascinating to see it. But the entities that issue bond, you could say that the only reason that they get to issue all these bonds comes down to the fact that people need a store of value. People are looking for a store of value because there isn't a good store of value anywhere because we don't have a good money. So the money is constantly being debased by government. And so the entity that can issue money, and that's government, and then secondarily the banks and the financial institutions that are able to, have good creditworthiness because they have large revenues coming in, they're able to issue bonds, and these bonds will effectively become the closest we can have to a store of value because these people have a constant cash stream from which they can continue to make payments. And so because of this kind of Keynesian idea of we shouldn't hoard money and we shouldn't have people hoarding money and we should just keep the money running, people end up using bonds as a store of value. But if you think about it, looking for a store of value function, there's no reason why a hard money wouldn't be better. Hard money would appreciate and would be protected from the downside, or would protect you from the downside, at least theoretically speaking, or at least that's what something like gold did. You know, gold never witnessed large crashes in its prices. Its price would just creep up slightly under the gold standard. It's really becoming clearer and clearer that Bitcoin is really, as Max is putting it in the chat, Bitcoin is bonds 2.0. Bitcoin is like an advanced form of running bonds. Like it's also bonds 0.1. Like I said, it's the prototype of bonds, was to just hold hard money and watch the hard money appreciate. But currently the standard for storing value is government bonds. And I think Bitcoin is infinitely better than this. In fact, if you think about it as the kind of risk-free rate, this is what bonds were, that you're getting this as risk-free because, you know, it's government lending. So government bonds are risk-free rate. And this is the rate that everybody can get if they just put their money in bonds. If you look at it and you compare it to Bitcoin, and Bitcoin continues to beat it regularly over time, I wonder why people wouldn't want to start thinking about Bitcoin as the risk-free rate. I think, you know, I was just tweeting something about this while I was thinking about the seminar earlier today. Anybody in the world can buy Bitcoin. It's available to everybody in the world. Everybody can find a way to get some Bitcoin. And so therefore, every money they spend can be measured. Its opportunity cost can be measured in terms of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is basically the universal measure of opportunity cost. It's the universal unit for opportunity cost. Satoshi is the unit for opportunity cost, if you think about it. Because anybody can always get Bitcoin. And so any money that you have could always have been into Bitcoin. And you can always track its performance over time and see how it's changed and how it's gone up. And so you can always really see how you could have done with Bitcoin instead of what you could have done, how much wealth you could have had with Bitcoin instead of whatever it is that you're doing. And if you think of it this way, the longer it continues to perform the way it has, the more likely it is to start becoming the de facto risk-free rate of return in many people's minds. Because you could always just spin up a Bitcoin node and a Bitcoin wallet and buy some Bitcoin and hold on to it and get that kind of return. So if bonds continue to offer negative returns and Bitcoin continues to appreciate without offering any returns, it's going to continue to be harder to keep up the pretense that bonds are better and bonds are the risk-free rate of return. When you think about it, when you see that insurance companies are getting into Bitcoin, that the most regulated financial entities are able to put Bitcoin on the balance sheet, like they would have put bonds. If you see that that's the case, I wonder how long it will take until people start thinking of Bitcoin as the risk-free rate. In other words, how long until we reprice the world in Satoshis? How long until everything's always measured in Satoshis? That's really, instead of there being a risk-free rate, it's just Satoshis. You're just thinking of everything in terms of Satoshis. And so you think of any use of money, you know, rather than calculating the interest rate. So right now, if you're thinking of making an investment, you think of the alternatives and you discount based on the discount rate that you would get in the risk-free rate. But maybe you should instead just calculate it in Satoshis. The number of Satoshis that you could have gotten, and then what has happened to the number of Satoshis over time. You know, this investment cost me this many Satoshis on this date, and then it will cost that many Satoshis on that date. And that just ends up being the equivalent of measuring the risk-free return. You know, you could have just put it in sats. And if you put it in sats, it really is risk-free because as Max is mentioning in the chat, there's no risk of supply expansion. Or let's put it correctly, I guess, it's the least risk of supply expansion anywhere in the world. You always know that you have a specific percentage of the Bitcoin network tokens. That's the one constant in economics. So you buy a chunk of that, and you know that you'll always have that chunk. You won't have that chunk diluted. And so if the network continues to grow, or if the network stays constant in terms of its size, then you still have the same, you still store the same amount of value. And given the enormous asymmetry between the potential for growth and the potential for decline in the network, you know, it could grow many multiples of how much it can decline. There's a huge asymmetry, which makes it worth taking the risk of the volatility and the short-term volatility that's involved. So in other words, the more that number go up, the more that we can continue to see this happening with Bitcoin, the more we're going to start thinking of Bitcoin as the risk-free rate. And I think the more that things like the insurance industry get into Bitcoin, the more that is going to reinforce this kind of take in many people's minds. And I guess, yeah, the end result is it might just be that Bitcoin is out there to disrupt the bond market in particular. You know, maybe Michael Saylor's point that we don't disrupt government monies, maybe there's something to that when you combine it with disrupting bonds. Because if you get rid of bonds, or if the market for bonds collapses and instead governments have to switch to a Bitcoin standard, then in that case, you know, they could charge taxes with Bitcoin and they could either peg their currencies to Bitcoin, or even if their currencies continue to inflate next to Bitcoin, you know, they continue to devalue next to Bitcoin. I think we'd have a very different world than if we had bonds. If we have bonds, the governments can continue to borrow and then devalue the currency later. Without bonds, they'd have to tax first, or, you know, have currencies that continuously collapse. I'd imagine it would be much harder for them to inflate in that kind of world. I'm wondering what you guys think. Do you think Bitcoin disrupts national currency or bonds or both? What do you think?
All the things, Soph.
All the things.
It disrupts all the things. It truly does. It's amazing. It's crazy. But now, yes, we've all been focused on currency, obviously, for obvious reasons. But now looking at this, you know, if right, the risk and probabilities are insurance companies' games, right? That's what they do. That's what they're expert at.
Yeah.
And if they're going to allocate into Bitcoin, what does that say to the rest of the market about Bitcoin as a risk asset? I don't know. I'm still trying to connect all these dots, but this news has gone insanely undernoticed in the community. It's really it's flown under the radar somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Currency doesn't need fiat. The fiat currencies I deal in don't need much of a push. They're kind of taking care of destruction all on their own. The bonds, Bitcoin is, I see a more aggressive posture from Bitcoin.
I'm not so sure. Let me make the case against currencies, fiat currency collapsing. Obviously, there's always fiat currency collapsing somewhere in the world, but the majority are holding up, at least, you know, relatively. Maybe the case is that as we start witnessing less and less debt creation in the financial system, maybe they can manage debt creation to prevent it from becoming too hyperinflation. There are forces for deflation that are taking place. There are businesses going under, and there's liquidation, and there's decreases in spending, all of which should lead in a deflationary direction. So the case for hyperinflation is not necessarily settled. But how do we combine that? On the one hand, that you have this debt dynamic on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you have people buying Bitcoin instead of bonds. If this continues, I mean, I guess governments, if they demand for their bonds collapses, then they're in trouble, right? They default or they need to devalue. It's pretty hard to see the case where the bond market dies and the currency continues to survive. Well, at least I guess survive is, you can make the case that it'll survive, but it'll be devalued massively. Like it'll lose a lot of its value. Maybe we just move to a new world where, you know, $100 is the new $1 and we pick up where we left off. Huge devaluation. And then we have fiat currencies without bonds. Is that making sense?
Who cares what you use to buy macaroni?
Yeah, and it's basically, it'll be like theme park tokens. You know, if you're under the jurisdiction of a government, you have to use their Chuck E. Cheese tokens. And they do skim some profit from giving you the license to use their Chuck E. Cheese token. But without a bond market, there's only so much that Chuck E. Cheese can do for you, can do to rob you, you know? I think they'll be on a much tighter leash without bonds, if people hold Bitcoin instead of bonds. What do you guys think?
Well, without bonds, how can they do anything? Let's just get rid of them.
Yeah. But I mean, if governments want to just continue to keep their currencies surviving, I'm not saying there's any reason for money to continue to be provided by governments, but I'm trying to make the case for why government money survives even as Bitcoin eats the bond market. Hypothetically, can we think of it? I guess it's a tough one. Yeah, but I mean, whatever happens, it's not going to be fun for people who live off the printing presses of today, I think. Bitcoin is going to severely curtail people's ability to live off the printing press. How it does that precisely is still up for debate, I guess. And we'll see. Time will tell. Anybody have any questions related to this or anything else?
Another undernoticed story, I think, is the Oracle announcement. It had a lot of hype going into it, and we thought that they would be announcing Bitcoin, but they didn't, and we kind of moved on when they didn't. But they announced instead a $20 billion stock buyback, which is obviously legacy thinking, legacy kind of financial engineering. I'd just like to get your thoughts on that, if you wouldn't mind, Steph.
I think it's Michael Saylor really explains it. The idea of buying share backs compared to Bitcoin, for him, it was his second, I think, option. He was going to either buy Bitcoin or buy share backs. And I think as the bubble continues to inflate in the stock market because of monetary policy, then you're going to expect to see more of this kind of trend of share buybacks and Bitcoin buying. You know, I think they can't just keep putting $20 billion every quarter into share buybacks forever. Eventually, they're going to try and experiment with Bitcoin. This is the thing about it. I mean, it's just, Bitcoin's just, if it continues to operate, it's just going to continue to be there all the time. And all these other things are going to reach their natural limits, because you can't keep making more and more share buybacks. If they continue to make more money, they're going to need to find other ways of doing it. They want to keep cash on hand, and they're going to have to buy bonds or cash or Bitcoin. And I think the case for Bitcoin is going to become more compelling. I think people underestimate just how quick Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy moved. It's absolutely amazing. They moved within a few months, and then they started offering all these convertible notes in a few more months. It all started about a year ago. A year ago is when Michael Saylor began to go down the rabbit hole. And 1 year later, MicroStrategy has more than 90,000 Bitcoins, and Michael has got something like 20,000 or something more than that. I can't remember the exact number, but yeah, they've got a whole bunch of Bitcoin for him and for the company. But, you know, Michael Saylor is the CEO and the founder of his own company, and he's a major shareholder for it. So he can have pretty significant leeway in moving the company. I think he's extremely brilliant, so he was able to get it very quickly. And he had the ability to act upon it very quickly. Like, he got it and he could just go and execute. The vast majority of companies have much more of a separation or distribution of powers, if you want. There's you know, a CEO that just was hired 3 years ago or 5 years ago, and he's an outsider. And then you have major shareholder groups who might have different views and different interests, and you have a legal team, and you have accounting, and all these people have their opinions. And it's not easy to get a massive corporation to move and get everybody on the same page and quell everybody's doubts and superstitions and weird beliefs about the digital currency. It's going to be a while to move those companies. So, you know, these kind of companies eventually will be coming around just because it's Bitcoin's better money. It's got what corporations crave. If you remember that movie Idiocracy, when they talk about electrolytes, it's got what plants crave. Well, Bitcoin's got what corporations crave. It provides good storage of value. So I think they'll come around. I'm not too concerned. They should take their time and make sure they buy at a higher price so that, you know, there's more for us at this price. Another question I got was from Browning on the case for holding gold. And Browning is a longtime subscriber. Back when I was on Patreon a couple of years ago in 2018, 2019, he was in one of these seminars that he used to do then, which I wasn't releasing as a podcast back then. They were just for subscribers. And he remembers asking me on the case for holding gold. And back then I made a case for why, you know, gold is still the strongest money or the second hardest money, and it's still got much more liquidity, and I can see the case for it. And so he's asking me if my opinion has changed, and I think the answer is yes. I think the case for holding gold today is far less compelling than what it was a few years ago, and that is because, quite simply, of number go up technology. The price of gold and the price of Bitcoin really is the scorecard for this relationship. Since 2018, 2019, Bitcoin at that point was maybe like $5,000 or something like that. So Bitcoin's gone up about tenfold. Gold has gone up approximately 0%, plus or minus. I'm not sure what it was around that time. But in about 3 years, 3 years and a few months perhaps, the value of Bitcoin and the liquidity of Bitcoin has gone up around tenfold. So there's 10 times as much liquidity in Bitcoin now. The value of the Bitcoin in terms of real goods and services is 10 times larger today than what it was back then. And so clearly, you know, the one advantage that gold has over Bitcoin is being eroded. And that was really the key point that I mentioned, is that if you think of the hardness, of course, Bitcoin is harder, or it's going to become harder. But if you think in terms of the liquidity, you know, there's just far much more gold all over the world. And so the chances of being able to use gold for trading with somebody else are larger than with Bitcoin, because there's just so much more gold everywhere that you can trade. But that advantage is decreasing because gold is not growing as much as Bitcoin is growing. Bitcoin's growing much faster. And so it's already up around 10x since then. And so it's not quite as big as gold yet. So the total gold market is about $8 trillion or something like that. Bitcoin is at around $1 trillion, but it's only an eighth of it. And I think, you know, the last 3 years, it's only 3 years, but it's still not, it's not nothing. It's a decent amount of time. In these 3 years, we've seen an enormous amount of monetary expansion all over the world. And yet we've not seen the price of gold rise, and we've not seen, and this is really perhaps more important, we've not seen the development of a mechanism for trading gold and settling gold worldwide. This is really the thing that continues to refuse to come out. And the reason is because governments don't let these things happen. So you can't just build a bank based on gold. Holding gold has capital gains tax. And so if you were trying to use it, it's not very convenient for it. And you can't just, you know, there are no gold banks anywhere. So this continues to make it harder and harder to use money as gold. So even though there's more liquidity, that liquidity is only accessible for you to some extent if you move the gold yourself. You know, you pay with physical gold, which really is very limited, because very few people want the exact coin of gold that you have on your pocket at this point. And then, you know, you look at gold with banks, it's pretty slow to move around and you don't have payments denominated in it. So because this is not the case, the saleability of gold is across space is unlimited. And therefore, it continues to fail to rise in value. It continues to fail to increase in terms of its size. And that, I think, is making it effectively become demonetized. As we mentioned in one of the earlier seminars here, as long as the percentage of economic value that's captured in gold dwindles compared to the rest of the economic value that's in other goods and services, then gold becomes relatively cheaper over time in terms of real goods and services, and then it becomes more likely to be used in industrial uses rather than held as monetary demand. And so if you start taking away some of Bitcoin's, some of gold's monetary demand, and it starts getting used for industry, you're effectively lowering the stockpiles of gold on the world market and making the price of gold, making the stock to flow for gold lower. So if you're making the stock to flow lower, you're reducing the degree of how much of a money gold really is, because then it becomes more sensitive to supply shocks. And so the reality is, in 3 years of, you know, prices are going up in real terms, there is inflation. If you look at real estate and if you look at hard assets, there's inflation in all of these assets, but it's not coming to gold, which means that gold is becoming relatively cheaper, which means that it's going to start getting utilized in industry more and more. And it's going to lose its monetary premium more and more. And that in turn makes it less likely to appreciate with a growing monetary medium, monetary premium in the future. So it becomes an industrial metal like copper and silver. So, you know, with every day that the gap in price or with every day that Bitcoin continues to grow faster in terms of US dollars than gold does, this becomes the likelier scenario. And so the scenario that gold can continue to, can go back to being money is, continues to get weaker and weaker with Bitcoin, with each day in which Bitcoin grows. I've written in one of my subscriber bulletins, which is something that's going to get, that's being transformed into the fiat standard now. I'd written about how the best threat to Bitcoin, the best way that you could stop Bitcoin would be to go back on a gold standard. I think if governments were to go on a gold standard, it would really have the best shot at killing Bitcoin. I don't think it would kill Bitcoin, but I think it'd have the best shot at it, because it would really undermine Bitcoin's value proposition. Because a lot of what has driven Bitcoin is the fact that people are afraid of inflation and people are afraid of financial censorship. But if you go back to something like the gold standard, if you go back to free market in banking, then you would undercut these two drivers of demand, and you would get much more of a demand for government monetary systems. Like if everybody could use government monetary systems and they were neutral and they were easy to use and they had a hard money, that would seriously take away from the case for Bitcoin, I think. But again, with each day that Bitcoin continues to survive and a gold standard is not implemented, this risk becomes even smaller and smaller, because the more Bitcoin appreciates, the more people realize that it does have it more than just gold. It doesn't just offer us, you know, protection from inflation. It also has serious NGU potential. It has serious number go up potential. It can increase in value. And so even if you were to reinstate something like the gold standard now, you know, so many people are hooked on the number go up smack that they will just keep coming back for it. It doesn't really matter anymore. The case for Bitcoin and number go up has become, I think, quite compelling. You know, Bitcoin could stop growing for another 5 years, and at the end of the 5 years, there will still be a lot of speculators coming and expecting us to go back to what we had more than 5 years ago. The chances of gold monetizing continue to decline every day that it doesn't monetize. And it's declining more and more. So I think the case for gold, to go back to the original question, I think the case for gold is continuing to get weaker and weaker. Owning gold as part of a portfolio continues to make less and less sense. I think it's going to be really hard for it to have anything like the returns that you would expect over Bitcoin, from Bitcoin. If you start thinking gold opportunity cost in terms of Bitcoin, it's not looking good for gold bugs.
Wouldn't it be a big challenge anyway to ensure a peg, really? So a trustworthy peg between the gold that you have in your vault and the money that you base on it? Because you never know whether the gold is still there.
Well, I think technically we're at a point now where you could actually, if you wanted to do it technically, you could do things that are, you could arrive at something like this with like pretty good levels of observation. Like if you had a free market, I can imagine that banks would have cameras 24/7 recording their vaults, and they would be broadcasting all the moves of gold into and out of the vault. If you wanted to do something like this, I can see the market providing solutions like this if you had a free market. But the reason we don't, I think, is political. It's not so much the technological limitations. In at least in the case of the verification, well, no. I mean, obviously, it's nowhere near the level of verification that you get with Bitcoin running your own full node. But you can improve on what goes on with gold, I think, significantly from what's happening now, which probably involves a whole bunch of tungsten being held by a whole bunch of people thinking of it as gold.
Safety?
Yeah.
Have you seen Breedlove's conversation with Saylor, that 9-part series?
Yes, I haven't finished it all, but yeah, I've seen quite a bunch of it.
It's interesting to hear somebody converse from an engineering perspective instead of a political science or economic perspective. Not that he doesn't understand both those issues very well, but it was interesting to hear his engineering brain discuss how governments exist because they were needed to handle the arbitrage, the physical movement of gold. And then that led him to the perspective of why he's in Bitcoin. But I had to listen to that about 3 or 4 times. He says a lot without directly saying it. I found that really interesting. What's the purpose of government? Well, or not what's the purpose, but why did they exist? Well, we need to handle this gold.
Yeah, I think ultimately the physical nature of it means that whoever can have the biggest gun in the surroundings of the biggest gold vault will end up with some margin for error in terms of their ability to print more of it. I'd say that's really how I would think of it. And yeah, and Bitcoin really solved this because it just takes it out of the physical realm. It takes it out of the realm of physical attack and just makes it digital, which is amazing. I also got another question from you, Nathan, by email, speaking of gold and gold bugs. This one is by Jim. You mentioned that Jim Rickards and Alasdair MacLeod, or MacLeod, they make the point that Bitcoin's fixed quantity is makes it unsuitable as a monetary standard and that it'll have to fail. And it's the same tired Keynesian idea that, you know, there's not going to be enough Bitcoins. Oh, no, Bitcoin will fail because there won't be enough. And so it'll become, too expensive. It's like the old, nobody goes to that restaurant because it's too crowded. Well, if it's too crowded, it can't. Some people must be there. And so similarly, if Bitcoin appreciates, you know, it can't be not attracting demand. So the question is, why would it be attracting demand if it is appreciating as money? And the answer is, because it is used as a store of demand, as a store of value. So MacLeod and Jim Rickards argue that because its supply can't increase, you won't be able to get a bond market. It's not going to be possible to have a bond market where people pay returns in a Bitcoin world. They present this as if it is a big gotcha. Like, yeah, well, if you have Bitcoin, then you don't have a bond market. And you just want to shake them and tell them that's exactly the point. If you have Bitcoin, you don't have a bond market. You just have Bitcoin. You don't need bonds. There's nothing physical in the planet that requires bond markets to run. Bond markets are a convoluted way of financing government and providing people with a store of value. Bitcoin provides people with a store of value and provides the solution for the problem of government financing by essentially cutting it off from the currency. So the government has to finance itself, not by manipulating the currency. I don't see why this would be a problem. And it's quite funny to see supposed gold bugs bring up this issue. So,
if this is correct, you know, if gold's growth supply is high and that's the right answer, well, then why isn't silver better money than gold? Because silver has even better, faster supply growth. So this idea that the supply has to grow only at the magical percentage rate of gold, I don't think can really hold much analytical water. I think it's far more likely to be the case that the supply grows. The money is chosen because it has the lowest supply growth rate. So gold has been money for thousands of years because it has the lowest supply growth rate. If there was something with the lower supply growth rate, I think it would displace gold. I think the process that takes us from copper to silver to gold would take us from gold to whatever had a lower supply growth rate, because I don't see any need for a positive supply growth rate for any of these monies. So the question then becomes, you know, why would it be a problem? Why would it be a limitation? It's not clear why that would be the case. I think in a Bitcoin economy, we're likely to see equity replace debt, but I don't see why that is a problem. You know, people can take on equity when they want it, and then equity trades in financial markets. And exposure to equity is how you take risk, and holding cash is how you store value. And these two functions basically fulfill what everybody wants from their portfolio. You know, you want some things that you can guarantee for the future, and then you want some things to take a risk with. And cash would be that. You know, it's a 60-40 portfolio, which has been very popular for quite a while. That you put 40% of your money in bonds and 60% in stocks. I think you'd see something similar, but instead of 40% going to bonds, 40% would go to Bitcoin. I don't see why that is a problem. Can anybody see a problem with this?
It's the future.
It's a spin mathematics to the right of the decimal place. I've racked my brain. I don't get their argument.
Yeah. You know, Jim Rickards has made a name for himself since he's constantly pooping on Bitcoin and Bitcoiners recently. I'm going to take some liberty with giving my opinion of his. I've read his book a while ago, one of his books, which I highly don't recommend. And essentially, the business model for Jim Rickards is that he's spent the last, 20 years, maybe more than that, going around telling stories about he's really like the worst kind of gold bug. Those are the people that give hard money a bad name. He's going around giving stories of, you know, how the dollar is going to collapse and gold is going to rise to 5,000 or 10,000 or 15,000 or 20,000. And this has basically been his same pitch for 20 years, that gold's going to go to these insanely high numbers. And he's always shady thing about him is that he's always going around pretending that he has knowledge of inside sources at intelligence agencies who are telling him all of this stuff. It's ridiculous because, you know, it's not entirely clear why intelligence agencies would be giving this guy this information to put, classified information to put in his books that he sells publicly on Amazon. It seems to me like they would, you know, find a way of stopping him if he was giving out classified information, allegedly. But, you know, who am I to judge? But yeah, but so basically the idea is that there's always going to be this giant clash, and then gold is going to rise, and the new global monetary system is going to be built around gold. And so buy some gold from him and his website. And, you know, he's kept that shtick going over the last 10 years, even as the price of gold has basically stayed the same. So imagine how these people feel when they watch Bitcoin come and do exactly what they had been expecting gold to do for the last 20, 30, 40 years. You know, they've watched Bitcoin. They've been getting asked about Bitcoin by gold bugs interested in Bitcoin since Bitcoin was around $1 maybe or $10. And they've just continued to dismiss it and watched it go up and up and up and add another digit and add another zero. So it's kind of understandable that they would come up with rationalizations for why this thing doesn't work, why that thing doesn't work. And I think in this case, you know, they've latched onto some Keynesian story about there not being enough Bitcoin for their Keynesian fantasy. So unfortunately, they're not going to be joining us on the Bitcoin train, and they're going to continue to enjoy the collection of Petrox.
It's interesting that people that are public proponents of free market, when they see one, are the most afraid of it. Just total fear of a free market by people that constantly talk about them.
Yeah, it's true. It's quite interesting, actually. It's really the position of being a libertarian and not being into Bitcoin, or being into hard money and not being into Bitcoin, is becoming quite untenable, really. It doesn't make sense. If you're into separation of money and state, if you're into hard money, if you're into the free market money, you have to be at least sympathetic to Bitcoin. You know, you have to be at least willing it on, wishing it to succeed. You can't square those two contradictory beliefs with one another. So it's the effective solution to the problem of money and government. Like it's an actual actionable solution that anybody can adopt. Just get your money out of your government's money and put it into Bitcoin, and you will have increased the degree of freedom that you have in the world, and you will have decreased the amount of power that the state can take from you, and so reduce the power of the state. I can't think of anything more effective to do. But a lot of people are more, I think, interested in the journey, if you want. They're more interested in the struggle than in the goal of the struggle. They're more interested in the fight than the outcome. And the old saying, you know, they're more interested in fighting the guard than in securing the graves, as I said before. Like, people can get emotionally stuck in the processes and the mental models that they give for the world. They become more interested in validating their struggle than they are in actually triumphing in the struggle. And I think that's where a lot of people get stuck with Bitcoin. That's where, because it develops this little glitch where, you know, it becomes a part of their identity. But no, this thing can't work. And the more it works, the more it triggers them, the more angry they become, and the more it doesn't have to work. And the more, in their mind, it has to not work. So, yeah, it can be frustrating being one of those people and watching the price rise. So, good luck.
Do you get much feedback from the Mises Institute regarding your work? I'm surprised that I don't see more people competing with you, if you will, not necessarily trying to sell a book, but just in terms of Austrian economics analysis of the Bitcoin phenomena. It seems that Austrian community would just be totally fascinated with it. I don't get that sense. What's your thoughts on that?
No, I think they're quite interested and fascinated. Jeff Deist, the president of the Mises Institute, is a good friend, and he's always promoting my work to their members, and he's invited me to their conferences. And Tom Woods and Robert Murphy and Per Bulund are good, are also quite sympathetic to Bitcoin. It's quite interesting, actually. The Mises crowd have always had a much more favorable take on Bitcoin than most other hard money and libertarian circles. So if you look around, for instance, like the DC think tanks, for instance, the Cato Institute, have been just insufferable no-coiners for the most part. Well, maybe not all of them, but quite a bunch of them have just been quite negative no-coiners. You know, this is the first free market alternative to central banks, and they're constantly talking about free markets, and yet when the free market throws us an actual alternative, they're sitting there and pontificating about why Bitcoiners are stupid and why Bitcoiners don't understand proper monetary economics. And they're just sitting there, you know, trying to find something wrong with Bitcoin. People like Rickards and a lot of gold bugs also have the same kind of perspective. And you start seeing that it's really not about the end goal with many of those people. It's about they get lost along the way, where they just get obsessed with their own little pet struggles or their own little jobs. But I think people in the Mises Institute have had the most open-mindedness to it. And, you know, they may not be cheerleaders of it. They're not constantly thinking only about Bitcoin, but they have other things they think about. But they get the significance of Bitcoin and they support it, I think, much more than other groups. Thank you very much, guys, for joining us today. This was fun, as always. And I will see you in the next seminar on Monday. Take care.